What will make a distributor reject a chain of title? When do you need a release when filming in a public place? Do you need life rights to make a true life story? How long do you need to keep production documents? Is using news-based content in your work fair use? What contracts do you need when using music in your film? Those are some of the questions we're going to tackle in today's Ask an Entertainment Lawyer with entertainment lawyer and filmmaker Chris Edgar.
This is the Working Director Podcast, a show that helps you go from emerging filmmaker to working director. As a filmmaker living in Los Angeles, I've directed over 130 projects, including 6 distributed feature films, all while helping filmmakers figure out how to level up in their careers. I do this show with one goal in mind, to help you become a working director. And if you want to join us for the live Q&A sessions and ask all of your questions, make sure you join our free private Facebook group by going to theworkingdirector.pro.
I figure we could talk a little bit about what our team is currently going back and forth on Messenger, which is considering doing a project that's based on a real life inspirational story. Do we actually need to get rights to do someone's story?
Not the story per se, but if you're going to use their image and likeness, then you're going to need a license for that, or you're going to need to be able to show that, you know, your use of it is going to be fair use. If you're going to use any copyrighted clips of them, then you're going to need to show that that's fair use as well, like, you know, video or photo or things of that nature.
Well, let's say I'm going to make a story about Chris Edgar's life, and I'm going to cast somebody to play you, and we're never going to show the real you, but we're using your name and what we know your true story. Do we need to get your permission?
Generally, I don't have a right to protect the story of my life per se, but it would still be a good idea in that situation to get a release from me where I say, where I consent to your discussion of me in the film, because that way I won't be able to come back and say, oh, you misrepresented something about me and that harmed my reputation. In other words, make like a defamation claim. So it's best if I release you from all potential claims that I might have in connection with the film. I can't say, hey, you're about to tell my life story, so the law gives me a right to stop you.
And I figured that to be true because I've seen plenty of unauthorized biographies. So,
like the Elizabeth Holmes one that was done recently on Hulu, yeah, presumably she didn't, you know, authorize that.
I guess one thing we could discuss is when you have these teams. So you have, you know, we have a team of a few producers, we have a couple writers, we're all kind of doing a project together. It's not traditional. We're normally like a writer has written a script and then we option the script and then we moved into the next stage. You have teams like this. What is your recommendation to them for to kind of keep everything above board?
If you feel like you're at the stage where you're ready to form an LLC that is one specifically relating to the film, then I would recommend doing that for the usual reasons that I drone on and on about to you all the time about protecting yourself from personal liability so that anyone who wants to sue based on some issue that they have with the film or the preparation for the film, they have to sue the LLC and not you personally. If you don't feel like you're ready to get to that stage yet, then I would form what's called a collaboration agreement. And that would be an agreement that essentially states that all of the people involved in this agreement, in this collaboration that we're doing, they're all going to play some specific role when it eventually comes time to go into pre-production and production. That way, people don't feel as if there's a possibility that they could do all this work, you know, for financing the film and putting together pitch decks and trying to attach talent and so on, and then get kicked out of the project, you know, and then lose the value. Also, it should clarify, ideally, that no one is the employer in this situation. So no one's going to come back and be like, hey, I did some of these film decks, so why don't I get wages or something like that? Why don't I get paid by the rest of the group? And yeah, and clarify that you're not forming any kind of legal relationship like a partnership or a joint venture. Usually these kind of agreements terminate, and I just did a video on this, which is why I'm just reciting all this stuff from memory right now. Usually these agreements terminate when people actually form an LLC, because what the LLC is going to do is it's going to employ each of these people as producers or as writer-directors or what have you, you know, the role that they're going to play in the film. So the collaboration agreement is really kind of a temporary measure until people are ready to form an LLC and draft an operating agreement and articles of organization and all that good stuff.
Something we're asked often, do you need permission to film a march or public protest on a city street? If you're going to use it in a film, TV show, YouTube, do you need clearance?
Generally, people don't have a right to their images and likenesses when they appear in a public place or a right to privacy. And so usually, yeah, you don't have to worry about that. If you're filming in a setting where you require permission to get in, like you're entering some sort of corporate office where the general public isn't normally allowed, then it's best to get releases from people. Now, that being said, the most prudent thing to do is always to get a release to the extent that you can. I mean, obviously, you can't go up to, you know, 1,000 different protesters and get a release. So, yeah, in that situation, it's a good thing that the law doesn't require you to do so. But to the extent that you can, it's a good idea, because then you can add in provisions that protect yourself into that release, such as if someone sues me and then the lawsuit gets dismissed, then they have to pay my attorney's fees, for instance. That's a great provision to have so that people can't, you know, go after you and sue you just to get leverage in order to try to force you to give them money, even though they know that their claims have no merit.
That question was from Lucky in New York City. And Lucky, I actually filmed an entire music video during a women's march. It makes it look like we have all this money because we have all these background actors. When we do anything non-scripted, is we just have a clipboard of release forms. So if you do go up and talk to someone, you could just have them quickly sign a very simple release so that you have it. It's not that hard.
Doing interviews with people, I would definitely recommend getting a release. I mean, if you're just filming, you know, the protest or the march or something like that, then, well, as a practical matter, you can't really worry about it. But because it's taking place, you know, in a public place, it's not something that you have to be very concerned about. But I would definitely, I mean, particularly because somebody could say, oh, you know, something that I said in the interview was copyrighted, for instance, right? You want to make sure that, you know, people can't bring claims like that. So you do want to have this interview release if you're actually talking to people.
Music rights and clearances. People want to know, especially when they're going to film festivals, they want to know, do they need to have clearance to do a film festival if they're using a known artist? Obviously, I think people realize they have to have releases if they're going to go broadcast anywhere or theatrical. But what about things like film festivals or just going, you know, to YouTube? What do you tell people for that stuff?
If it's a known artist, then even if you are, you know, using a clip from their song or something like that in a film festival screening, you're still going to need a release. Now, as a practical matter, if it's a relatively small screening and nobody knows about it, it may be too expensive to get a release. And it also may be too expensive to go back and edit your film and take out the copyrighted piece of music that you used. You may want to take the risk. But from a legal perspective, even if the copyright holder can't show that you caused them to lose money as a result of, you know, screening film containing their song at a film festival, it's still possible for them to get what are called statutory damages. And this is an important thing to know when you're making this kind of decision. In other words, they can still get a court to require you to pay some amount that's between, I think it is $500, it's like $75 and $30,000, depending on what the court considers to be the severity of the copyright violation. And that's per copyrighted work that's used without authorization. That's something that you should take into account when you're thinking about whether to screen a movie that uses somebody's copyrighted work, even in a relatively small setting. U.S. does have laws that are pretty strict about this kind of issue.
Yeah, and I've heard stories of people who have used famous pieces in festivals and they have gotten in trouble. But even unknown bands, the newer artist, you're a lesser known artist, I've had some luck just going to their label or to them directly through like Facebook and getting them to jump on board. So it's not easy. That's why it's great if you have a music supervisor who can handle all that. Lucky asks, what are the top reasons a distributor will reject your chain of title?
So the chain of title, just so that everybody is on the same page about this, it means essentially the document that establishes who owns the IP associated with the film, which usually means the copyright associated with the film. So you could say that the chain of title starts with the writer, that is the person who writes the script. They get copyright registration certificate showing that they hold the copyright in the script. And then the next step in the chain of title is the writer assigning to the LLC, that is the production company, the right to make a film based on the script. Technically, the chain of title extends to basically everyone who works on the production. So an actor makes a creative contribution to a movie by appearing in it, for instance. And that's the reason why it's important to have the actor sign a release saying that they can't make any kind of copyright claims based on the fact that they made a creative contribution to the film. So yeah, it's a concept that actually can end up encompassing, you know, most or all of the agreements associated with your film. Now, when you're talking about a distributor rejecting the chain of title, what I understand that to mean is a distributor saying, you haven't given us all of the documents making up your chain of title. So if you were only to give them a copyright registration certificate and a contract with the writer saying, you know, the production company has the right to make a film based on the script, they may say, that's not going to be enough. You have to give us all of the agreements that you made with your cast and crew members, with their releases of any kind of copyright claim, and their releases of any kind of claim based on your use of their image and likeness. We need all of that just to make sure that no one, whether it's an actor or a crew member, whoever, is going to come back and say, hey, you used my creative contribution without my permission, and that's a copyright violation. You used my appearance, you used my image or likeness in your film without my permission, and I can go after you for that. So it's really a way of the distributor trying to protect themselves as much as possible from any kind of liability based on these claims that you used a copyrighted work or image or likeness without permission.
When we turned over all of our docs to our distributor for the last movie, I don't feel like they really looked that closely at things, to be honest. So it's more you're just covering your own butt for these things. That's why I always say, if someone appears in or on your set, get a paper signed. Or before your set, or touches your movie, or, you know, whatever it is, like, just have everybody sign things.
And what you specifically want them to sign in the agreement, the important clauses are an image and likeness and release. So they release the right to use their image and likeness in this film for any and all purposes, in any and all media, in perpetuity, you know, that usual language. And you also want a clause, and your distributor is going to ask for this too, saying that they can't get what's called injunctive relief, which means an order by a court saying that the film can't be released. That would be a really sort of drastic remedy that a court is not likely to order. But it's still important if you want to, you know, cover your bases as much as possible to make sure that no one can get that sort of thing. And of course, if someone were actually able to go into court and get that kind of order from a judge, then the distributor would lose the whole value of their investment, which is why it's so important to distributors that you have that kind of clause.
I mean, it's funny because we're talking about chain of title, and I'm thinking back to my first feature I ever did. It was like me and friends. And I'm pretty sure even then, even though I probably found my stuff on Google, I had everybody sign something. Because here's the thing, like that film didn't get distributed. It took like 7 years or something before a distributor, like I had a relationship with the distributor who could distribute this first film. And I still had to provide that stuff. And that's before it was digital. So I have like this, like, you know, these binders like this for these movies.
You even had a big binder for The Breakout, right?
Yeah, The Breakout is huge. I think The Breakout is the last movie that we did on everything on paper. After that, I think we started going digital, which is so much better. And now you have, you know, my file system is literally like past projects, and it's every single project and then every single thing that ever went on with that project. If it's a production Bible, if it's contracts, timesheets, payroll, like everything for those projects, we could always go back and find. So I think it's important that people start thinking about that. It's digital now. You can keep everything. But that's actually a good question though, Chris, is how long do I have to keep stuff? So like, I guess since Love or War is still being distributed and still online, then technically I need to still keep all that stuff. But let's say I have a movie that is no longer really anywhere, then is it safe to toss that? Or do you say no, still keep it for a certain amount of time?
Yeah, I mean, these days, since you can keep all your records digitally, I don't really see any need. Too expensive to keep buying more hard drives, you know, to store documents and stuff like that.
Documents are so small, but I'm thinking like for those of us who have these binders that are taking up storage space and attracting spiders, like what? At what point can I be like, yes, I can finally toss this?
If the distribution of it is complete, like usually these distributor contracts, they tend to last for 10 years or something like that. And if, you know, the parties don't choose to renew those agreements and you think that there's nothing more that you're really going to do with the film, I mean, yeah, that's a long time after the distribution starts. But at that point, I might feel safe, you know, if I had a huge room full of binders and I wanted to get rid of some of them, to start trashing some of them. But the safest thing to do is always to preserve your records. And now that it can be done digitally, I mean, it's not that much of a hassle.
For sure. And the digital stuff, fine. Yeah. I've even thought about scanning all these old things, but they're so fat that I'm like, I'm not going to take the time to do it. Lucky has a great follow-up question to releases. He says, if you get consent on camera recorded, do you still have to have a hard signature? And I'm assuming this means those quick on the fly interviews that say like a protest.
You can get that kind of consent. I mean, it's the reason why it's best to have consent in writing is because then there's not going to be any kind of ambiguity. You know, if you're at this noisy protest, it's not difficult to completely make out what someone is saying to you when they're consenting to the interview. Then you don't want there to end up being a dispute later where they can claim that, oh, no, that's not what I said. So that's why a hard signature is always best. But I mean, legally speaking, somebody can consent to being recorded orally.
I also, lucky in those instances, on those on-the-fly interviews and such, I love to get their name printed and make sure it's legible. And their email, so I can contact them later to even say, hey, this is out now. Or if you have any follow-up, anything at all, you know how to reach them. So I don't know. If you're going to do that kind of thing, I would just carry these hard releases. But it's good to know that you can just say, you can get it oral and be okay. Margaret has a question. Can you use radio news voice recordings in a narrative documentary film? What is the clearance needed for news-based content?
Well, most of that content is copyrighted unless the copyright has expired, and it's probably not expired if you're using something that's TV or radio news, because the copyright is going to last under the current Copyright Act 7 years from the end of the life of the author. So if we're talking about a work made for hire for NBC News or something like that, the life of the author is going to continue, you know, for the foreseeable future. And so the copyright's not going to expire. So technically, under the Copyright Act, you're required to get a license to use the news or radio footage. However, there is something called fair use. And that is a doctrine that often applies in documentaries, because what documentaries typically do with video or audio clips that are copyrighted is they use them in a way that's called transformative, meaning that they give the clip a purpose that it didn't originally have. Let's say you're filming a true crime documentary and you're talking to a witness to a crime. And then in the background or in the picture, you're showing these copyrighted news clips regarding the incident. In that sense, you're giving those news clips a purpose they didn't initially have when the news crew filmed them, because they were just trying to broadcast the news and, you know, make money for their channel or whatever. But in this case, what you're doing with it is you're giving context to what the person who you're interviewing is saying. And that's why the use is transformative, which is a big factor that works in your favor in determining whether your use of the copyrighted work is fair use and therefore protected from liability under the Copyright Act. Hopefully I didn't say that too quickly, or it wasn't too complex for people who haven't heard fair use to understand. But I have videos on my channel, by the way, which is my Film Tracks channel on YouTube, where I go into a lot of detail about these issues.
Yeah, I would recommend everybody go over to Film Tracks and dig deeper into this stuff if you need. And always, of course, you can always reach out to Chris. Margaret has a follow-up question about the music. For music and voice, is a materials release enough, or are there other sync rights releases needed?
If you're using a particular music clip, then your release should include both the composition rights and the sync rights. So the composition has to do with the music and the lyrics of the song. And the sync license has to do with the way in which the sync and the mechanical licenses have to do with the way in which the song was recorded. So the way they actually put it down on tape or on the video or whatever it might be. And whatever sort of license you sign with an artist or a record company is going to contain releases of all of the composition and mechanical and sync rights. If they don't, then you need to be using a different license form.
I've always been very confused about the difference in all the music. Can you break that down to, so I can take a track and lay it in the background as just like soundtrack. I can take a track and have someone say lip sync to it. I could take a track and rewrite or have someone re-record it. You know, there's all these different ways that you can do music, and you have to get rights for each of those. Is that correct?
One thing to have somebody perform a song, let's say that someone wants to perform cover of Justin Bieber, Love Yourself or something like that. They want to do their own version of it where they play guitar and so on. Then what you're going to need is the composition rights, theoretically. That's what you're using. You're using the music and lyrics to the song, but you're not using Justin Bieber's original recording of it. Whereas if you wanted to use Justin Bieber's actual recording of the song, then you would need what's known as the mechanical rights. So there are different types of rights an artist or the record company, if they've assigned them to the record company.
So here's where I get confused, because I always hear you need sync rights and or background rights. And those aren't the same things.
Sometimes the artists will split up those rights that I've been talking about into rights associated with the context where you can use the music. So sometimes the artist will assign people the right to use their music as background in a YouTube video or Instagram or TikTok or something like that. And they can do that. They can split up the rights that they hold under the Copyright Act in these various ways based on the media in which their music is being presented.
Such a great service you're giving, like just a half hour of free legal advice. Like, again,
legal information is how I would put it.
Legal information. It's funny because you usually say, I'm not a lawyer. This is just my opinion. But you're like, I am a lawyer. But it's still just my opinion.
If I were going to give legal advice, then I would need to understand the particular circumstances of the people I'm talking to, which is why I don't refer to it as legal advice. It's more like general legal information.
Thanks for listening to the Working Director Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, please rate and review, as it helps others find the show and helps us keep making great content for you. And if you want even more help with your directing career, check out theworkingdirector.pro, where you can apply to be part of the accelerator that hones in on where you currently are and helps you get to where you want to be. Whether it's this podcast, the accelerator, or our free Facebook community for directors, we're here to help you get to work.